Okay, good afternoon, everybody. This is going to be a theory talk, I hope. If David is successful, I won't progress beyond slide 8. So I put a little bit of introductory background material in the beginning. And I want to start this by Henry. Okay. By trying to connect to what Mike presented yesterday. So some people were asking after Mike, why should we care about how many exactly of these ion channels are there in the initial segment, and it's only 20 micron away, come on. One shouldn't bother about it. So I would like to, because what I really want to present is motivated by this. Answered Herbie's question, why one should care. So there are different reasons, and they are the background of this work. This work is, what I'm going to present, is mostly done by Michael Monteforte and Tatiana Chumachenko. If time allows, a little bit of Wei Wei's work. I can't get hold of a picture of Wei Wei, and so you know who is Michael Monteforte, right?
No, I never
heard of him. Ah, but you recall. you wrote in this email, right? So because Michael was determined to work on cortical network dynamics, we had the idea to have him in David's lab for a while.
Oh!
Yes.
He came.
Yeah.
And then he came for a day, and then he got involved with a woman, and then he left.
Yeah, so...
that's really amazing.
Wow.
I'm impressed. Is a single neuron enough to make it?
So I want to complete this. So being in David's lab can break your heart. And
what
happened? I never even got the sign out of it.
It was so fast.
But in the end, this other member of UCSD then married him, and she now emigrated to Germany. So that's the happy ending of Michael's visit to UCSD.
The same way.
Put down your
oh, wonderful. Well, he was in your lab very briefly.
This is what we attributed to.
And so now you'll see what you missed. Yeah? So, because most of this work is Michael's, from Michael's PhD work, which is now getting together. So have we still gone? Well, there you are. So why care about the initial segment? First of all, because of self-respect. I mean, the initial segment is, where's the pointer? I'll use the solid-state pointer. The initial segment is what sets us apart from slugs and flies. This is from a recent paper on the evolutionary history of APE generators, published in PLOS Genetics. And what they indicate here is that before the study, one knew already that mouse, all vertebrates that were studied in sufficient detail have certain anchoring sequences on their sodium channels that make these channels attached to initial segment proteins. So one thing that Mike only briefly mentioned is that in this piece of the neuron, there's a specialized cytoskeleton. So if I magnify this, a little bit of memory, okay. And so it's not only that there are ion channels, there's a thick cytoskeletal matrix attached to the membrane of the initial segment that is specialized. So there are proteins like beta 4 spectrin or ankyrin G that go only there, and a whole lot of other proteins that are just being cataloged these days. And they interact with ion channels. And the recognition sites, they are only present in us, whereas they are not in say, Drosophila sodium channels. And these guys then worked out when in the history of animal life the initial segment and myelination and nodes of Van Weeck came about. And
they're it's not present in mouse or pigeons or zebrafish or monkeys?
It is. We share it, yeah.
Okay.
And this paper, which is the first phylogenetic study of initial segment proteins and ion channel evolution, argues that all of the ion channels that we have in our, the 10 sodium channels that we have in our genome, evolved in the context of the cytoskeleton of the initial segment. And so here, this is where our current theory of action potential initiation comes from. That is on a different branch on the tree of life. But this is not a pen, okay. Matthew Rasband wrote a comment on this paper in the same issue, and he concluded that the initial segment may be one of the reasons for our success. That's certainly misguided. I mean, look around on this planet. Arthropods are the success. So maybe the initial segment is why we are not yet extinct. But one should also keep in mind that most of the vertebrate species are also extinct. So they were happily getting extinct and having near-death experiences with their initial segments. But as Mike and David and many others over the past couple of years pointed out very, very clearly, this is where the neuron decides to initiate a spike, whether it sends something to the rest of the brain or not. And so that's the other reason why one has to really care about the molecular organization that occurs exactly in this position, because they decide. And so by the position, the question that was hard before has become even harder. So that is a quote from a paper by Trockwell, David Hansel, who will come later here, Karl van Vreeswijk, and Nicolas Brunel. It's a very nice paper that I admire a lot. It was the paper that introduced the exponential integrated and fire model, and in the discussion it has this nice section: how sharp are spikes in cortical neurons? ? And in the 8-sentence review, they summarize basically what is still the state of the art today, that the key features of the sodium current and of the onset of spikes are currently unknown to us, because that's what Steve Smith stressed in the first week. If you want to know the properties of sodium current that are essential for determining the onset of the spike, the decision of the neuron to fire or not to fire, that is near threshold, at very low open probability, and that's where basically no data is available. And if you realize that it is a decision that is taken in the initial segment, this means we have to know these properties that would be hard to obtain even in the soma, in a place that is quite hard to access and offers all kinds of opportunities to produce artifacts and so on. So this is maybe a small compartment and it's very close to the soma, but it's super important if you want to understand how neurons decide to spike. Yes.
So I mean, it's just background material, but you're saying that sodium channels that are in the soma are not anchored the same way the sodium channels are in the initial soma.
That's what many people believe. So one classical result on sodium channels in the proximal axon was estimating their diffusion constant in the membrane. Walter Stürmer did that in 80-something by bleaching. And his measurements indicated that diffusion constant of sodium channels in the proximal axon is like three orders of magnitude lower than in somatic membrane. And the anchoring protein, what's it? occurring G. That is only present in the initial segment and in the nodes. So there are specialized cytoskeleton elements that have adapters for sodium channels, also for potassium channels, many of them, so they cluster them. And they seem to be present only in these highly excitable subcompartments. And so then, there's this other. So now I'm getting to the background. So there are two simple, or actually there's one clear reason why you would have to anchor them. The majority view of the initial segment is that this has a very high density of sodium channels, as also of potassium channels. And if you don't want to have them diffuse away, you should rather anchor them to some structure that keeps them fixed and reduces their diffusion constant. But as Mike showed you in his talk, the evidence that there is this super high density is ambiguous. So all their observations they could explain with just a factor of 3 more ion channel density in the initial segment as compared to the SOMA. So what other reason might there be to put these channels in particular positions and keep them there and have multi-molecular machinery that clusters them in groups? There's very little knowledge on how ion channels behave that are clustered as compared to ones that are dilute in membranes. And probably the major reason is that ion channels are so strong current sources. If you have a single sodium channel opening per square micron of membrane, you are in the middle of an action potential. It's a very strong current source, and that's why the membrane is not full of ion channels. But there are a few exceptions, and this one I put because Herbie has worked a bit on them. So that's probably the ion channel where we have the super best evidence that it is clustered and that they are in touch with one another, ryanodine receptors. Those are from sarcoplasmatic reticulum in the heart, cardiac myocyte. They are so clustered, they actually form a crystal. So each of these are giant molecules, 700 nanometers big, and they are arranged in a square array. And when Marxeter studied them in black membranes, they found that there are different gating behaviors depending on the density. So here you see 3 current recordings, voltage clamp recordings from these black membrane preparations. The lines here indicate single channel currents under these conditions. And so here you see a low and 2 higher open probability recordings. And so here it's clear there are 2 channels present, but these channels open and close simultaneously. Okay.
Fred, how do the only 2 channels present? They never see just 1 channel open.
In this?
Yeah.
Okay, they can. So that so
might be a side point, but the side point, don't worry about it.
No, it's an important point because so this is where we have currently the best evidence that ion channels when clustered can do this. Also because this lab at Columbia has really control about whether they gate in a cooperative fashion or gate independently. There is a small peptide that is thought to bind to the edges of those ryanodine receptors. When they wash it out, FKBP something, now it's called calstabin. If they wash it out, they become statistically independent and recover the prediction.
Okay, it's basically the same channel.
So you can turn this into that by washing out this peptide, and you can recover cooperative gating by washing it back in. Still, it's highly controversial in cardiac research.
Chris, why is this cooperative gating?
Because why is it not calcium-induced calcium-induced?
It's just a change in gating mode.
This current flows through 2, and they open and close simultaneously, and it is not calcium-induced opening of the ryanodine receptor, because the same behavior is found with barium that wouldn't bind the other ryanodine receptor. Answers your question?
I see. So that's 2 channels getting together.
Exactly. They open together and they close together and they open together and they close together.
Rather than because there are subconductance states.
Ah, yeah.
And so you would have to be sure that you weren't going just one channel, but going to two conductance, subconductance this, states.
Yeah.
Those would be the subconductance states, and the one below would be the full open state.
It depends on your definition, but this is believed to be a single channel full conductance state. Yeah. And
actually, there are subconductance states lower than that.
Yeah, so it's a complicated story. There are, but so this thing is believed to have four pores. At least some labs think that each rhinodendron receptor has four pores, and they open and close simultaneously to give you the unitary conductance. But this is a bigger conductance.
I just can't see how you can be sure that the top one wasn't one of the four channels or two of the four channels, and the bottom wasn't four of the four channels in one unit.
What is called subconductance states, but you are probably better into that literature.
Because when that happens, you see something that's one quarter that size. Mm-hmm.
So you
get the actual quantized current value. So subconductance state is one half or one quarter of that size. And that's two. So in some units, you start off.
So for rhinodendron receptor labs, this is a big current. It doesn't get larger for most of the labs. And the Marx group finds three times the. So it's a subconductance state of the channel multimer, maybe.
Yeah. So functionally, what's the difference between this kind of channel, of cluster of channel, and a huge one channel, big one channel?
Nothing. The big one channel does not exist in biology.
Functionally.
I'll come to that. That's a good point. So couldn't we just build bigger channels that would do the same job as a assembly of cooperative negating channels?
Well, you also could believe that depending on binding of other molecules, you could change the gating.
So, as you wanted, I will not proceed beyond the introduction.
I have a stick.
Yeah. Okay. So, but I mean, certainly you think this is insane. He was starting talking about the initial segment, and now he's showing us something from the subplasmatic reticulum of the heart. So I'll go a bit closer to the thing and show you a bacterial ion channel. Okay. this is a recording from KCSA. The one potassium channel. We're also switching ions now from calcium to potassium.
Kept the charge
calcium. And it's a famous ion channel because all of you know Rod McKinnon got the Nobel Prize for solving the structure. It's the ion channel that is probably still best known in terms of molecular structure. The first one that was crystallized and gave good X-ray. But surprisingly, very few labs have worked on its physiology. So only a few months after a paper of my group that I will also come to was published, this biophysics group from Spain, Molina et al., published the first study of these channels expressed in giant vesicles. So here you see one of the giant vesicles. They put KCSA channels in abundance into this membrane and recorded from these vesicles. And here you see two recordings in which they found, going that way, it's a outward current. These are the different single channel conductances. And what you see here is a FRET fluorescence image from such a channel, indicating that in some regions of the vesicle, these channels actually clustered so tightly that you had first a resonance transfer between the fluorophores on the different channels. So that's also a preparation where there is okay evidence that the ion channels cluster, and it is on the other end of the spectrum of ion channels. I mean, I showed you one of the biggest ones, several hundred nanometers. This is as small as it gets. It has only the two transmembrane domains that form the pore region and the selectivity filter, and nothing else. It has no gating charge, also noteworthy. But if they cluster, groups of five channels open and close simultaneously, they see in these recordings periods where they show this cooperative gating, interspersed with periods where you find independent gating. But it's really large groups that seem to be capable of opening and closing independently.
You can see the same thing that looks exactly like that in glutamate receptor channels.
Ah, yeah, that's the fourth example of cooperative gating.
But the people who did the glutamate receptor channels thought it was different states of one molecule, mm-hmm. not cooperative gating.
So finally, I want to show you the first ever observation of cooperative ion channel gating in a voltage-sensitive ion channel. And that is a vertebrate mammalian sodium channel from the heart. So this is old paper of Ilya Flyder, which was one of the players in this study. It is from cardiac myocyte membranes, again, attached recording. Under conditions under which EM work showed that membrane particles cluster. This is ischemic heart, so cardiac myocytes under ischemic conditions are treated with a metabolite that accumulates them. And so here you see again, it's now an inward current, and these dotted lines are the single channel currents that you would expect. And in 10% of their patches, they found that groups of two or of three of these cardiac myocytes, ion channels, NAV 1.5 probably, opened and closed simultaneously. And so it's not just that if you think of cooperativity, there are gray shades of cooperativity. You can imagine if one channel opens, it makes it 10% more likely for the neighboring channel to open. This seems to, like the other two examples, to be very, very strong cooperativity. They just behave as one unit.
Are there any examples of weaker cooperativity?
There are examples of weak negative, so I wouldn't call it, that's Stempli, right? There are recordings from frog nodal membrane, I think, where they see that opening of one channel reduces the current through the other channel, or maybe also the open probability, and that is gradual. Yeah, you need to do the statistics.
See, just from what you see there, you couldn't tell if this was four channels or one channel that had three conductance states.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But fortunately, we know the single channel. Biophysicists think they know that a single sodium channel has like 15 picosiemens of single channel, and that would correspond to one of these dashed lines. So, but there's also discussion for cardiac sodium channels about subconducting states, but these would be correspond to smaller currents on this scale. So cluster channels, all of them that have been studied, can enter in this cooperative mode of activation. And that's something that could be orchestrated by forming them through interactions with the cytoskeleton into supramolecular complexes. And why would it be of any functional significance? So that's maybe your question for this case again. All of those have a voltage sensor. Now, by making them move like one, one way to couple them would be such that their voltage sensors have to move unisono, which would give them effectively an n-fold gating charge, which we would predict to make them much more voltage sensitive than a single channel would be. So if it's not very hard to work out the be open of such a coupled channel array, and when you have the Boltzmannian open probability as a function of voltage for a single channel, after a certain coupling strength, they will collapse to a ferromagnetic phase transition and enter into and then as a collective exhibits a step-like activation function. It is. It's like if you allow many channels to interact, then it's like mean fields, Ising.
Yeah, but it's not first order.
Depends, yeah. The if you want to ask your question, so how would you emulate this with a single molecule, a single big molecule? You would have to put more and more gating charges into that protein. And maybe there's a natural limit to that. So in spring, I was at a meeting where a student, a co-worker of Besanilla, actually presented a study where they tried to increase, to up the gating charge of a voltage-sensitive ion channel. And what they achieved was that the channel got leaky, and actually the effective gating charge was less. Probably these 12 elementary charges that are put into the protein are at the limit where you can, maybe it's flying apart. It's not easy to, you have to balance these charges to get the protein to fold. So that is one of the reasons why one may be really very interested in the organization of the initial segment. It's, as neurons are concerned, speculation, but why am I entertaining in them? So a couple of years ago, reading about Einstein cooperativity is also fun. So this is one quote that I found in a review by Dennis Bray and Tom Duke, people that worked on receptor cooperativity in bacterial chemotaxis a lot. And in this nice review, Conformational Spread collected all the evidence there is currently for coupled or synchronous conformational changes in proteins. And one of the examples you see in this line that the evidence depends on who is looking at the evidence. So to a true believer, there can be no planar demonstration of cooperative gating. They call it conformational spread. And this is a very influential paper in a sense, because think of the previous KCSA study. Of course, in the discussion, they had to say something about the mechanism. How do these simple minimalistic ion channels talk to one another and coordinate? And they said, obviously, it is conformational spread.
It's amazing to me that they are fluctuating together. These very short fluctuations, if they've been mediated by cytoskeleton coupling or something like that, and how does that work?
There's no time scale on that, so maybe that's...
It's actually quite a long time scale. I think this is 200 milliseconds.
Yeah.
So they stay open for a long time. This is a high open probability state.
You never see them fluctuating, very short fluctuations to one or the other, two or three open.
In these papers, the three of them, In those experiments, they didn't go for very high temporal resolution. So it would be really interesting to look into these phases. Yeah, do you see the subconductances or the partial conductances come on one after the other? Yeah, but there's no such information.
But if you measure the activation curve, reactivation of this channel, you would assume that you get something like one big channel. So even in the activation curve that you put into your model, mm-hmm. you put the slope, this sigma or k or whatever, mm-hmm. of this big channel, and in simulation you have the sigma of the big channel. So biophysically it may be interesting, but with respect to dynamics, it is the same as one big channel.
Okay, in the conductance-based model, you could emulate this with an effectively larger gating charge. That's what I... I totally agree. It's not one big channel, because in a conductance-based model, you are talking about the open probability of
a...
Even in the heart, at least according to Marx, the way things that happen is that adrenaline can modulate the amount, which gating mode there is. So for example, if you have adrenaline, you can open the channels more easily because you decouple them. So, why would you expect the same thing in the neural system? There could be some other molecules or some modulators that can change the gating mode depending on.
But I will, if I get to give my talk, I'm not sure whether that's going to happen. I will follow exactly your model and through a mean field description that you, on the face of it, couldn't distinguish from one big channel with a big gating charge. The question is rather, what is the relationship of our effective models to the molecular details in the system? Whether you should take your 12 gating charges from the structure of the, or from the tail of the open probability of a single channel, and use that as the parameter in this model, or whether you should have a much larger effective gating charge to really emulate what the neuron does. And why do I care? I mean, a couple of years ago, we looked into the detailed kinetics of AP onsets as they are visible from recordings at the SOMA in vivo and in vitro. And we were surprised, and five Nature reviewers were surprised that they were starting so rapidly. So these are phase plots from an in vivo recording in a complex cell in cat visual cortex. Graphed here is the membrane potential of the cell and the rate of change, 15 volt per second. And there's two things that I want just to point out to remind you. The interpretation of this is controversial. I'll tell you two stories about it. But the fact is that, so this gray cloud are sub-threshold fluctuations. And the in red, we marked the onsets of full-blown action potentials. And we were not the first to see that there's a wide range of voltages where they initiate. And there's a very nice work by Bill and Hicks that shows that you can actually manipulate the range of threshold variability by taking out a certain type of potassium channel in the initial segment. But it's quite broad, yeah. So, and then this rate of rise is much larger than what you find in the simple biophysical neuron models that many of us use to simulate cortical neurons. This is a driving a neuron model designed by Alain Destex with a fluctuating current. And so this rate of rise is very much shallower. And there's a clear voltage point of no return in this model, which is absent here. And the threshold variability was reduced well. So the one thing that one should not miss here is that these action potentials ride out of a symmetric cloud. So that means that in many traces, the membrane potential fluctuates up beyond potentials where this neuron made many spikes in the past or will make many spikes in the future, and just bravely fluctuates back, not caring to introduce a spike. So at least this is good to educate students. That's what I use it for, to tell me where the threshold is. And I think that is a valid point of view, because I believe in the consensus that this initiation site is only 30 micron away from where we record. But David showed that the electrotonic length is hundreds of microns in axons. So for things that happen before the onset of the action potential, the initial segment and the SOMA is pretty much isopotential. So before you initiate the somatic voltage, there's every reason to believe that it's a good proxy of the voltage at the initiation site.
Was that electrotonic length, does that go back into the SOMA, or was that just along the axon?
I think you measured it into the SOMA. So you wiggled on the end of the axon with the voltage and measured the decay to the SOMA, but probably both ways, right?
It's more complicated. The electronic length from the SOMA down the axon, it's 300 microns for DC, or slow, very yeah. slow fluctuations. It's very frequency dependent, of course, because it's filtering. Mm-hmm. So with high frequencies, I don't know. We plotted it in a supplement. It would be much, much shorter.
Sure, yeah. It depends on the frequency of the process that is needs to propagate. And that's why I say, so sub-threshold voltage fluctuations don't reach much beyond 10 hertz, 20 hertz, then they are gone. So for these low things that happen in between the spikes, 30 micron away has a good chance to follow that. And that's why, so probably the reason why you can see a substantial reduction of threshold variability at the SOVA when you take out these KV1 channels in the initial segments. And so
if I took all my neurons in the brain that had all the voltage in the left panel, replaced it by something in the right panel, would my brain stop working?
That's the topic of my talk. Yeah? In a certain sense, I'm going to try to explore that, because this is so. And so what we did in that paper, where
the answer to the question, all your neurons are the ones on the right.
Well, no, the ones on the right now, the old one.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. Yeah.
The last one, mm-hmm. The last slide. All your neurons are the one on the right. That's just
not my neurons.
That's yeah.
No, my neurons. They're especially tuned to follow Fred's model.
So
your neurons.
There's disagreement on
neurons.
Actually,
the real neurons are the ones on the right, and you record what's on the left because the spikes are initiated far away.
Well, that's an idea.
Yeah.
What exactly did you plug? I just didn't get it. So you take two consecutive samples and plug them, the difference versus the mean?
This is the rate of change, so V dot.
So you take two consecutive Voyager samples?
We did actually something more complicated. We fitted a function through, I think, three or four consecutive sampling points, and then took the
and the lines there you get because you connect the phone?
Which lines? These are
as a function of time. So a fine. Line is sort of
it is a trajectory. Yeah, okay. Line is v and v dot as a function of time, and interpolated between the measurements. Because you're right, there's only here and there a measurement, yeah. And in between. It is an interpolated
line.
Can
one of you or both of you elaborate on that comment? So where are the recordings being made? Where are the spikes being
made? So we all agree that these recordings were made with a sharp, in some with a patch electrode on the SOMA. And we all agree that the spikes initiated not in the vicinity of the electrode, or for some in the vicinity of the electrode if 30 micron is close enough. And so you can now, there's two ways to interpret this finding. One is that it indicates that the sodium channel that elicits the spike, the sodium current that elicits the spike may have a very fast kinetics or very voltage sensitive kinetics. The other is that this current dissociates from the voltage at the SOMA, which is graphed here, because it is a current from elsewhere. It's coming down the axon. It's an axial current. And therefore, it may, in principle, totally dissociate from the voltage there. So the question is, how good is this voltage a proxy for the relevant voltage at the initiation site? And there, so different groups have checked this in models. And in our experience, there's a wide range of multi-compartment models where you initiate 30 micron away, you record at the SOMA. The phase plot that you would obtain from the initiation site or from the SOMA are virtually indistinguishable. But you can tweak your parameters and get also other conditions where you can really get this initiation much sharper. One way to get that is to put these astronomical channel densities into the initial segment, and that's why I find it very interesting. What is our hard evidence as to this high or low channel density? Another argument that I think is important is that it has been long known to electrophysiologists that antidromic action potentials are very sharp, right? So if you elicit in some other brain region an action potential that travels back to the SOMA and hits the SOMA at resting potential, you have a floor effect that starts really very fast. And by that analogy, you may think, okay, if this initiation site is here in the axon, and then it travels back the action potential, it hits the SOMA, that is a very simple picture how it can be so fast. Why do I stay unopinionated about this? How big is an action potential? That's a, I'm certainly, you ask your students.
Yeah.
In basic biophysics, how big action potential?
Zero.
Okay. So,
if you did a plot like Mike showed yesterday, where you had dBdt versus t, and you see the inflection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would the data you show there give the same thing?
Yeah. It depends. In some of them we had a single phase, but in others we had a double phase, and probably so the more you balance the bridge, or how they call it in the lab. So the typical action potential has two phases, yes.
The typical ones do have an inflection there, if you look at dBdt.
Mm-hmm. So what I draw here is the second derivative, that's where it gets even more pronounced.
So Fred, so
did I complete my... Okay, yeah, no.
You didn't answer my question. So if the answer is, maybe you don't know, but the answer is no, then we don't care, right? If the answer is yes, we care a lot. If the answer is maybe, then maybe we care, right? Is that, would I, be my question?
I didn't get the question.
My question was, if you have two models of neurons, right? You have one on the left and standard one, right?
Uh-huh.
If you put those different neurons into models of the brain or into the real brain,
it
make a difference. So the answer, you may not know, right? But
that's what the talk is about. So there will be a huge difference, okay?
So my brain really won't work if you put the...
I don't know whether you... Actually, how your brain works, I thought...
Easy.
Hey,
Fred,
why
don't you say that,
yep,
that in this VDT plot, why aren't you seeing the...
okay, because we cut it here. So the peak depolarization is like 300 volt per second, yeah? So it goes up and then... So in above the... Yeah.
So Fred, maybe we should get to the interesting part of your talk.
Yes, I totally agree that would be the aim.
This is your second question now.
No, I asked the same question twice.
But I have to complete the story for which I woke David up, so that's...
can I make this one?
Yeah, yeah, make your comment.
I can make lots of comments. I'll make one. Can you go back one slide? No.
Oh, wait, that was...
The forward is good.
What is this?
That's
the left.
Forward,
the previous
no, forward. Forward. Oh. I just wanted you to go to the right panel.
Okay.
Yeah, there it is. Okay. This is exactly what we record when we record from the soma and the axon initial segment at the same time, the same spikes. In the soma, they look like the one on the left, and where the spike initiates, they look like the one on the right.
So what David says is that when they record it from the end bulb of a cut axon close to the soma, they found something like this. And that maybe we can continue the discussion on this later.
Okay. We discuss a lot about this model, but you don't discuss the issue of cooperativity. So it's still unclear to me if, and indeed, the cooperativity means effectively one big channel, figure. How do you get these strong kinks with the Hershey-Huxley model or something similar, with just replacing the small ion channels, sodium channels, by one big sodium channels? What's the difference? What do you get?
Because you have a different voltage sensitivity. It's not just that you have 20 times the conductance, you also have 20 times the gating charge.
This is the same aim, an infinity that you measure and expand.
No. Okay, let's discuss this later. Yeah? But you have to change the activation curve. And that then is different from...
Okay, that's the issue.
So faster activation, the less it's...
Faster activation will not do any big change because all of these simulations are with tau m equals zero. So there's two time scales that are important here. So that another time scale. Actually, I'll come to this other time scale that is still in the problem, even if you send tau m to zero. So you make activation instantaneous, but there's a certain speed limit that you can't beat, and that comes mostly from the gating charge, from the slope of the activation curve of the sodium current. So that will be the main player in the main part of this presentation. And the discrepancy, or we agree to disagree, on the value of these axonal recordings, whether they actually prove that at the initiation site you have this conventional kinetics. So what I want to talk about is the impact of different designs of AP AP generators on the collective dynamics of large networks in asynchronous balanced states, like the ones that were mentioned already several times in this week. And the so this is a topic, because I don't know whether the biophysical aspects will remain relevant or really be ruled out, but this is a topic that theoretical neuroscience needs to answer. And in certain dimensions of collective activity, we have pretty good concepts. So when you think of rhythms and synchrony in large networks of neurons, work by David Hansel and colleagues and many other labs have given us the tools and the concepts to think about what is important for rhythms and synchrony. We know that subthreshold oscillations are important, that synaptic delays, phase response curves, these are the things that need to be understood to have a good assessment of whether a network will synchronize or not, or what the frequencies are that it generates. But there are also these asynchronous states where there's no collective rhythm. These are two simulations from large networks. Here shown are raster plots from 60 cells. And in these, there's a slight tendency to synchronize, and here it's absolutely absence. And okay, for rhythms and synchrony, we know we have a lot of good ideas what is important for the collective behavior in terms of single cell properties. But for asynchronous states, that need also be to be understood. Actually, it's not very easy to pose the question, right? I mean, what these are, by definition, featureless, indistinct. What could depend on single cell properties in such a state? So that's the question that I want to address here. And it's a perfectly nice and valid dynamical systems question. But in neuroscience, you also have to say something about how the brain works. Okay. Fortunate or unfortunate as it may, so now you can choose whether your brain works that way. I'm not sure. It's for me as undecided as the nature of sodium current. So imagine you have a network that ticks on like this, and you want to use it to store information in state over time. So there's an initial period where you modulate the input and kind of put information into a network cycle, like preparing an initial condition. And then when, as time proceeds and after termination of your input, sure there will be some information about the initial condition or the stimulus that you transiently applied in the firings of these neurons. So that is the overall thinking in what is now called, I think, echo state or liquid state computing. And you may want to ask for the dynamics of spiking networks in these irregular states. How is information preserved or recoded or degraded by the intrinsic dynamics of this network, of this large dynamical system? And how to quantify how information is preserved or destroyed? And what would we expect? Well, this is a large, many component, nonlinear dynamical system. So it's not it will be a generic guess that the dynamics may be chaotic, and chaotic dynamics will in general lead to information decay. It will mostly degrade information that you put into an initial condition. And so let me illustrate that here. So if you think of the activity pattern in a large network in state space, so this line here is meant to symbolize the progression of states over time in a chaotic system. If you prepare the initial state with some uncertainty in an initial condition, by the chaoticity of the dynamics, this region will spread in certain dimensions. It will compress in others, but importantly, there are dimensions in this state space in which small differences are growing. So in this scheme, there's one box of this partition here, and after a certain time, the image of that box under the dynamics fills 8 boxes. So what we have lost here are 3 bits of information about the initial state. The stretching and folding of phase space in any dynamical system, that is described by its so-called Lyapunov exponents. So for an n-dimensional system, there will be n such exponents, and they tell us in the different main directions in which this dynamics stretches or compresses state space, how fast that goes. So in the conventional dynamics, distances will separate or contract exponentially, and the Lyapunov exponents are just the rates of contraction and expansion of these deviations. Okay, but I put these boxes in order to link to information theory, and there's a natural connection between chaotic dynamics and information in states of dynamical systems, and we'll use that to study the dynamics of the spiking networks, and that is the Kolmogorov-Sinai entropy production rate, that is defined as the rate of information loss over time. And it's a wonderful quantity, and but one or two systems, people have been able to calculate it really from scratch according to the definition. Yeah. So how can we do this for a network of 1 million neurons? Well, there's a shortcut that is valid under many circumstances found by a Russian mathematician, Pazin, in 1977. And Pazin showed that, for instance, when you can safely assume that the density, the invariant density of this dynamical system is smooth along the unstable directions, then the Kolmogorov-Sinai entropy, Sinai entropy equals the sum of all the positive Lyapunov exponents. So assuming that spiking neural networks are of this tame kind, we only, quote unquote, have to calculate the complete Lyapunov spectrum to find the rate of information loss. And so to start on this, we started the generic. Yep.
That seems like a strong assumption, right? Because the unstable manifolds will be in different directions at different points of phase. How strong is that?
It has to be locally smooth, not globally smooth,
right? I think it's smooth along these.
But locally, because globally they've got a mix, right?
Yeah, sure. Locally, only in the vicinity. So
locally smooth.
In the vicinity of a trajectory, and it's hard to say because on the high dimensional system, what the nature of the density is a super open problem. One has to seriously think about, because in low dimensions all these densities are multifractal, they have not really continuity properties in a 2D map or in a 1D map. The few studies that have explored invariant density in high dimensional dynamics found that they are fairly smooth. So one thing that I recall right now is a classical example is Lyapunov exponent as a function of parameter in the logistic map, which is not a continuous function. In 20-dimensional chaotic neural networks, there was one study in nonlinearity that traced it through the instability, and it was a perfectly smooth function. So there are experimental mathematics indications that high-dimensional dynamical systems are much more friendly than you would expect from the maps, but there's no single proof that I know.
So in that case, it wasn't calculated; it was just.
Yeah, it was an experiment. So we'll set up networks in the balanced state, and so it has been explained many times before, which is the simplest way to set up a network of elements such that. The net drive into any individual neuron is way above its firing threshold, but there's a net inhibitory draw input that cancels it, basically such that the mean input is below threshold, so neurons would never fire in this state if they were driven just by the mean input current that they receive. But the firing is driven by the fluctuations, and because the input correlation time is on the order of shorter than the interspike time interval, this is a natural way to get Poisson-like firing in a deterministic system. And so there's also a recent development in the literature that makes it quite interesting for us to examine this in a wide variety of neuron models, because the dynamical properties of opposed to the statistical properties of the balanced state seem to be very sensitive to single neuron properties. So when Karl and Chaim first introduced this way to construct a balanced network and worked out the mean field theory of it, they were actually capable to calculate analytically the largest Lyapunov exponent. And they found that this largest Lyapunov exponent is positive, but it's infinite. So nearby trajectories diverged faster than exponential. There was no real Lyapunov exponent in these networks. It was very, very chaotic, if you want. Over the past 4 years, a sequence of studies, and Raoul was a player in many of them, studied the balanced state in the simplest of all kinds of topologies in which you can get it, which is neurons that are driven from the outside and have recurrence only inhibitorily, so only recurrent inhibitory networks. Like if you look only at the inhibitory subnetwork of the cortex, it's just for, I mean, one could say it's an academic example, or maybe the intrinsic dynamics of an inhibitory network are interesting, need to be understood, but it's certainly more handy than a complete network.
That
depends. One very powerful parameter is the delay.
Yeah.
So that is classical work by Nicolas Brunel and Vincent Hakim that showed that in such a network, if the delay is longer than the critical value, it enters an oscillation, goes through Hopf bifurcation from an asynchronous irregular state to a population oscillating still irregular state. But here these studies are below that transition. They are in a situation where you have a constant mean firing rate, not an oscillation in the mean firing rate. And they calculated various estimates to the largest Lyapunov exponent. None of them was positive. And this phenomenon is called stable chaos. So it's a very irregular dynamics. But if you perturb a system state, it will converge back to exactly the same irregular, weird, random-looking trajectory after the perturbation.
So if there is no positive Lyapunov exponent, by definition, there is no chaos, no?
That's why Politi introduced this other term, stable chaos. So it's not chaos in the textbook sense, but it resembles chaos, but it's a stable dynamics.
So it's a sufficiently high-dimensional attractor that it looks chaotic to the eye.
There's a question, but it exists only in the thermodynamic limit.
In many systems, this is a transient state. So in the long term, a finite system would converge towards a limit cycle. But the time of that transient in all the systems that have been studied grows exponentially with system size. So in the thermodynamic limit, this would become the genuine phase. Or in a realistically large system, you would never see that limit cycle. Correct? But both of them are quite curious types of dynamics. So one is so chaotic that you cannot quantify it with our standard tools, and the other is not chaotic, but just looks very irregular. And one main thing that is missing in both studies is the single cell, or one very important single cell instability, namely the voltage threshold. So this was done with binary neurons, this is done with integrated fire neurons. None of them describe the dynamics of the AP initiation process itself. So to symbolize that, I put here the, you recognize it.
You're talking
the phase space of the Morse-Le Carre model. Yeah. And so generically, the phase space of your simplest type 1 neuron will have a stable fixed point and an unstable fixed point and a separatrix. And when you are to the right of the separatrix, you do a spike. So there's a, in the phase space of your single neuron model, there should be an unstable fixed point which is missing in both of them. And we were wondering whether that may lead to this very unusual types of behavior. So to get started, we use the simplest type of neuron model that has just these two ingredients, a stable and unstable fixed point, and otherwise is so simple, as simple as it gets, which is the theta neuron, the angle representation of the quadratic integrated fire model. Here you see the FI curve of a theta model demonstrating that it's type 1, so firing rate increases continuously and can reach as low rates as you want when you decrease driving current towards the firing threshold. And to make things simple, we also started by studying just the purely inhibitory network driven from the outside and neurons connected with randomly with connection probability k over n and synaptic strength that's scaled as in as you need for this mean field theory to work out. So constant times 1 over square root of k, that guarantees that your fluctuations are independent of the number of synapses.
Just so I'm correct, the state inner is basically the same as a leakage integrated fire, right?
No, it's a quadratic integrating fire. So if you graph, if there's a voltage representation, if you graph V dot versus V, this here is a measure of Rio-based current, and there's a stable and unstable fixed point. And the so why is it very convenient? I'll come to that again, because this V dot is V square. This dynamics has finite time blow up. So you reach infinity in finite time, like many people fear the Navier-Stokes equation may happen. And therefore, you don't have to introduce a threshold and a reset condition. You can study this type of neuron without reset. And therefore, you can, so equivalent to that, you can write it as a dynamics of the phase. And you don't need spike times, actually, to write down this dynamics in closed form. So this is theta dot. For every neuron I, there's one such variable theta. You have one term that is autonomous and one term that is multiplicative in the current that goes into that neuron. And this current is composed of the external positive driving current and all the recurrent synapses. And we, for simplicity, have them delta currents, so just charge deposited for every arriving spike. And you can write a condition that this is a spike time by just saying, OK, theta j, the sending neuron, the presynaptic neuron, should have phase pi. And the reason for that is that at phase pi, this here is 0, so theta dot is always the same when it crosses this spike point, which is different from your normal integrated fire type neuron, where you can reach the threshold with different V dots, and therefore you have to put them. So that's not necessary here, and therefore you don't have a theta dot on the right hand side, which is not what you want for a dynamical system. And we made things also simple in that there's no delay here, so it's instantaneous. The moment the spike is emitted, it also arises. And the reason is that then you have a really an N torus as a state space. If there was a delay, in principle, it could be infinite dimensional dynamical system. That is not a good situation to calculate all the Lyapunov exponents.
Fred, can you replace cosine theta with a different periodic function of theta and done the analysis? Or
we will do that in 10 minutes. Okay. So it's not only so that you can be sure that this voltage will go to infinity in finite time. You can actually analytically solve in between the spikes iteration of motion for theta or for the voltage. And therefore, with this choice of neuron model, you can do So because you can solve the single neuron model analytically, you can do what is called numerically exact simulations. So use your glue together your analytical solutions from spike time to spike time and write down the map between the state of the entire network now at this spike time to the state of the network at the next spike time, which is good because then you can calculate the single spike Jacobian. And to calculate all these Lyapunov exponents, you have to multiply up all these Jacobians. And so we designed these models, and that will be the recurring theme, such that these calculations can be carried through analytically as far as possible. Why is it called numerically exact? In your off-the-shelf numerical simulation, you have a delta t, and you have to vary, is this delta t small enough, and what is the error? In such a simulation, your numerical error is machine precision. If you can afford to have 100 digits, then that's the precision that you get. There's no estimates, no estimating of numerical errors that you have to do beyond that. So this is the first result of such a calculation. The Lyapunov spectrum of the purely inhibitory theta neuron model at 1 hertz firing rate. Okay, firing rate. What is graphed here is, so this has n Lyapunov exponents, so what one conventionally does in spatial temporal cases is graph Lyapunov exponents versus I, the index over n, where they are ordered. And these are such spectra for four different sized systems, so 1,000 neurons to 8,000 neurons, and they fall on top of each other, and that is what shows that this type of dynamics is extensive. So if you add more neurons with the same statistics of connectivity, you just add in more degrees of freedom here, which have the same properties. That's not a trivial feature of a network, because normally systems are extensive if they are composed of, you can decompose them into weakly interacting subsystems. And in the random graph, that is not true. So there's another reason why this is extensive that we don't understand completely. That is a very interesting topic on its own, but it's very good for the following consequence it has. So the rate of information loss in the network dynamics, that is the sum of all the positive Lyapunov exponents. And so because this spectrum is invariant, this information loss rate is also extensive. It grows linear with the system size. So that means that it makes sense to introduce the loss of information per neuron. If it wasn't extensive, that quantity would not make sense. So we can talk about the dynamical entropy production per neuron in these networks in this state.
Something seems weird here, Fred. We looked at randomly connected networks, and we found temporal memory is logarithmic and stuff. So it's a picture you showed earlier. It's input for a while, then you want to know how long information stays in there. And the temporal memory scales is log of the network size. Whereas you're saying
what network is that? Yeah.
What? That was Carl. That was actually Carl and Heim's binary network. So you think? What would you say would the temporal memory of this would be? Would it actually decrease with n? Or
no, that would be constant with n.
You wouldn't get this logarithmic. Okay, that's interesting. Because theirs is more chaotic.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting result. I can't make sense of it.
Can I ask a general question? Why are you actually using random graphs? Is there a biological reason? Do we know that neurons are connected randomly? Or?
We know that neurons are probably not random. It's for convenience and to start. And because many features are already present in networks of randomly wired neurons, and it may be not so far off. So that's a matter of test. One interesting way to go is to put more of the known statistics of connections and connection strength, heterogeneity, and motifs into this, but that would be the next step.
So how much do we know about that, about how different the neurons are actually connected?
From random?
Random graph.
One thing that is folklore about this is that certain motifs of connections between three neurons are much more likely than they would come out in a random graph. but higher order.
The state of the network here is dependent on the state of all the nodes, right?
Yes.
So it could have memory in another space, like fire and rake, for example.
Absolutely correct. So I'm talking about information in the microstate. Yeah. Next thing I want to show you is how this Lyapunov exponents depend on firing rate. So there's not the Lyapunov spectrum of this network. Although it's extensive, it depends on the state. So the higher the firing rate, this is from 1 to 8 hertz, the same network. First of all, the maximum Lyapunov exponent goes up, but more influentially, also the fraction of positive Lyapunov exponents increases with the firing rate. So it's interesting to look at the loss of information per neuron and spike. That doesn't come out as a constant, but it takes out the main dependence of the information loss. So we can say that in these networks, the information loss per neuron and spike is on the order of one bit. And that's a reason to, that is one point where we can compare this abstract treatment with numbers that we have with some certainty for our cortical networks now. So this one bit per spike, that is the same magnitude as current, or the still current estimates of the information that you can put into the firing pattern of a barrel cortical neuron by a strong stimulus. So if real cortical networks have information loss rates like this.
This is from Matthew.
Mm-hmm. And that the complete percentage that you can comment it, okay? What? So if I believe this number, and if with such a network, all the information that you can put into the spike time by wiggling the whisker would be erased when the next spike comes along.
This is a funny way of doing things, because mm-hmm. they knew when they put the stimulus in, mm-hmm. and they saw how well you coded it. That's exactly what animals don't do.
Yeah.
You don't know when the stimulus. Mm-hmm. There's no little green Martian in your brain telling you when the stimulus occurs. I don't know.
Yeah, would you think if they underestimated it strongly?
I think it's irrelevant.
It's an irrelevant number, but if you are in that situation.
Friend, but mm-hmm. it's an irrelevant number.
Not anymore, David.
Seriously,
yeah. it's not the kind of estimate that you do.
Yeah, but can you, so
I'm not,
if that was true,
but you could ask
what the animal does, could it do something to get more information out of it?
But wouldn't a relevant thing be
it could be an upper bound to a relevant thing.
The other thing, reason I'm not sure about it is that spike rates, I just talked about this with Mike, and the spike rates in layer 4 in the awake animal, there's a lot of quiet cells, but there's many cells that are around 10 hertz. Mm-hmm. I think it's modulated order 1 by mm-hmm. stimulus coming in. And these rates are much lower. The modulation rate is mm-hmm. lower. So maybe you would say it's a lower bound.
Okay, so other neurons could carry more information than in this study. But on that, so,
spike rates. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But even in a primary sensory neuron, you don't get much more. So it's this bit per spike is still the okay unit for even the sensory neuron. So I would be surprised if
up to 5 in the retina.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 5. Yeah. So it's the same order. By this comparison,
we would. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. We could get at.
So the point I want to make is that this rate of information loss is would be quite high. Yeah? We have to compare it to something to make such a statement, and that's the numbers that we have in the literature.
I'm confused conceptually about this comparison. So the latter thing is the mutual information between the spikes and the stimulus, and what you have is some measure of information loss in the dynamics.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why those are comparable.
Imagine you put this information into the spiking pattern, one bit for every neuron, and then you let the network evolve. The information that you put at the beginning will be superseded with time by aspects of the firing pattern that now code for channel noise. So the information that you put will be overwritten multiply information about channel noise at a rate of 1 bit per every spike and neuron.
You don't mean channel noise, you mean the intrinsic dynamics?
Yeah. Whatever it is, yeah, but so if there was channel noise, the as time goes on, this, your microstate will more and more represent the noise than the initial condition.
So then as soon as each neuron spikes once, you've lost all information about the stimulus that came in.
That would be the conclusion, yeah.
And more, because
I think the criteria should become
you have negative information.
But the temple size of the
neuron, especially for the cells that aren't clear
about 3 bits, not 1 bit.
Okay. Let me see,
I think that would probably be about right.
Okay. So you wouldn't also say it's 100 bit or 20 bits?
No.
And that's the only thing that I wanted to...
Look, 100 bits wouldn't matter. The argument would hold.
So is that guaranteed to be true? I mean, I'm just somehow thinking that, you know, there's microstates that, you know, increase, you know, that whatever change because of this Kolmogorov sweep, you know. Mm-hmm. But maybe there's some overall pattern that somehow is orthogonal to the directions in the space in which you're expanding that you somehow retain.
Yes, absolutely. I mean,
So that would mean you couldn't just subtract those two numbers, the bits, you know, minus the, because some, yeah, you know,
I just want to share with you my feeling that this is a big number. It is relevant when you want to store information in microstates. If you are happy with firing rates or with some projection, then there are other ways, but they are. So that's not what I'm treating now.
So the one thing that's, yeah, I know it's time to speak, but I mean, many people, including this morning, I mean, David mentioned that the idea of the sustained activity, the sort of match after delay task.
Yeah.
But things be going on for 20 seconds, which is maybe 200 spike times.
Mm-hmm.
So how does this drive?
How does that relate?
Yeah.
So that's what Sophie mentioned. That is, you put the information into a big network by just putting into the rate, which is maybe, so it's much less capacity than this. But you'll get more on this topic when David Hansel comes. So what they just did was to set up a really neat theory for persistent activity in balanced states. And
Nietzsche also gave a possibility of if you build your connections appropriately, then you can stay in this.
Yeah, that's one of the outcomes of this workshop. So we put this refire connectivity into the simulation. So let's see. But I'll show you another way to make this networks remember much, much more, not forget so fast. And that is by taking serious that there's a big flaw in this neuron model, which is that the timescale of the stable fixed point called membrane time constants is the same as the timescale of the instability. And that's super unrealistic, okay? So we would rather have a neuron model where you have this asymmetry, and you can dissociate the membrane time constant from the rate of rise of the action potential. So we constructed one that retains all these features that you can do the calculations on paper as far as possible, or to the same degree as here, by gluing together two theta neurons, two quadratic integrin fire neurons, and this model is defined by saying where the resting potential, where the voltage threshold is, what the slope is here and there, that they should meet, and that they have to meet with a unique slope, or parallel slope. And then there's a single new parameter, which is R, our onset rapidness, which would be big for very rapid onset spikes, and for R equal 1, we regain the theta neuron. And your off-the-shelf conductance-based model is like between 3 and 8, okay? So first let's look at exactly the same topology as before and make sure that we don't change the statistics. So it need not exactly be, but largely the firing rate distribution, the CV value distribution, and all the other statistics that we checked are very insensitive to the dynamics of the individual neuron, to how unstable the voltage threshold is. but the dynamics of the network seems to be very sensitive. So here are, for illustration, three raster plots, all of them for r equal 1, r equal 10, r equal 100, have two superimposed sets of spikes, one of them blue, the other black, and they are initialized closely but not identically to one another. So here in the simulation for r equal 1, we see that the spike patterns start to diverge after like 100 something milliseconds. All of them are, I think, again at 10 hertz. If you have the more unstable neuron model, the time at which the spike patterns show noticeable differences gets shorter. But for really fast, rapid rise neurons, this spike pattern remains in similarity for very long times.
My phone density is too low. I can't see any colors in those boards.
Okay, then let me show you the numbers. That's better. Yeah? So these are the Lyapunov spectra dependent on the degree of instability of the single neuron model, increasing R, single neuron threshold, more unstable. This is our old theta neuron result, the yellow one, and when you make the single neuron spike onset sharper, the main thing that happens is that this fraction of unstable directions is strongly reduced. So we have still extensive chaos for these different neuron models, but the fraction of unstable degrees of freedom decreases when you make your single neuron more unstable.
Do you excited to inhibitory networks also?
Wait a second. Yes. I can show. Maybe. Maybe I'll.
Technically, yes.
Yeah. So here are the graphs. So the maximum Lyapunov exponent, that has a little bit of what we initially expected. So you think if you make a single neuron more unstable, the collective dynamics may become more unstable. And that is true to some extent for the maximum Lyapunov exponent. So that increases with R initially, but then decreases for really large R. But the main effect on the Lyapunov spectrum is that the fraction of unstable dimensions is reducing. So the KS entropy per neuron and spike, that goes down continuously with R, and you can tune it down by orders of magnitude just by making the single neuron more unstable.
Wait, but that large R would be increasing coverage.
Yes, yeah. I mean, first putting the right gating charge into the, so up to here, it is putting realistic gating charge into a single thing, and moving beyond that is having some APE generator with more than biophysically realistic quote-unquote gating charge.
So then how could other animals survive? Like, I mean, leech, I understand, they move perhaps very slowly. They don't have this, going back to your initial remark, right? So leech moves slowly.
Yeah.
Squids are fast animals. So
well,
did I
say that this is good? The animals that don't have this rule the world. The question is why we survive.
So an integrated tire, could you consider that as a limit when the cell ratio becomes very high?
Yes, it's not exactly the integrated fire neuron for R to infinity, but we think it behaves like this. So we did this same thing for integrated fire networks and reproduced what Raoul and others showed before, that the entire spectrum is negative. And here you actually see that we can, that actually there's a finite R where the maximum Lyapunov exponent touches zero. And this critical R goes to infinity in the large N limit. But it shows that you don't need a non-continuous dynamic. So this is a continuous dynamics, but it has stable chaos for a large enough R. So here we have a crossover from conventional to stable chaos in such a system.
Exponential integrating fire, where would they be?
Exponential, that depends on your spike slope parameter. So our R is monotonous function of the spike slope parameter delta, and for the usual choice it would be here, yeah? But the usual choice is as taken from sodium activation curves
in all the cases.
And wait a second, and the ones that that Richardson and Wolfram Gerstner and co-workers estimated, they are a bit sharper, right? The spike slope factor is smaller than what you would expect from activation curves. But they do the same mistake as we. They fit the model to the somatic voltage. So that's coming back to this point. Many people, and so the currently the best models that we have to mimic spiking in these neurons are adaptive fitted exponential integrated fire, but they are fitted to a voltage that some physiologists believe are not really the voltage at the initiation site. So it should be a misfit.
So CP is equals one for all the models? I mean,
that remains asynchronous and CP and irregular for all the time. We calculated chi square. The statistics is up to the stable chaos range, very weakly dependent on this. And you can believe that, for instance, because, I mean, if that was not so, you couldn't build an integrated and fire balanced state, which is simple. So that's here for large R. And for small R, I showed you that it's irregular.
Mm-hmm. But does all this degrade gracefully when you go to less fast synapses?
It's becoming better with continuous, with correlated currents. So with correlated currents, David Hansel and Silver showed that in their paper from 2 years ago, you get conventional chaos already with a threshold neuron. So you move into this conventional regime, but even with correlated currents, the entropy rates that you get with the threshold neuron are orders of magnitude smaller than with the dynamical AP generator. So that means
you should maybe just tie it back to the original cooperativity.
I'm not sure it's related to cooperativity.
Sure, it's related.
Yes. Oh, okay. No. You're right. It's one good. There's another thing beyond cooperativity that can make a network more unstable, and I'm sure everybody agrees with this: is putting some excitation in can make things more unstable. Okay, so that is an issue that I don't want to skip, because you may think all of what I showed you indicates making the individual neuron more unstable, and putting a really rapid AP generator into it that gives a long dynamical memory span to this network. But but all I showed you are inhibitory networks. So the story could completely change if we study mixed networks. But that's not so. So these are the last results that I'm going to show. Will be the same results for mixed networks of an excitatory inhibitory population. And we have one scalar parameter by which we turn on the excitatory recurrency. For epsilon equals zero, there's no E excitatory connections. And this is matched by the inhibitory connection constant, such that the variance will remain invariant. When you turn on epsilon, your current variance will be conserved. So what you take away from what you gain in current variance by putting now excitatory synapses, that you take away from the inhibitory synapses, such that the current variance is preserved. It's still extensive, and we are still okay on the order of 1 bit per spike. And even in the presence of excitatory recurrent connections, the chaos entropy is a decreasing function of this instability, putting more cooperativity if you want. Yeah. So you can tune the network to the edge of chaos by making the AP threshold more unstable. So that's my conclusions from the first part of the talk, which will be the entire talk, I think. So balanced chaos in in networks that in each neuron have a dynamic AP generation is extensive and conventional, and we think it is well quantified by the KS entropy rate per neuron and spike. That is a relevant number when you talk about information in the microstate, in spike times or voltages, like Dimitri likes to put information now. This KS entropy rate can be on the order of 1 bit per spike in neuron, so quite high if you choose a single neuron model with a slow AP initiation dynamics.
Slow,
okay.
Just to fly back to the beginning.
Yep.
Slow means standard
Hodgkin-Huxley-like
AP dynamics.
Okay, standard Hodgkin-Huxley-like AP dynamics.
That probably has R bigger than 1, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's R, so it's like between 6 and 10. Yeah? If you fit your Conner-Stevens model or Wang Buzaki model, you have an R in this ballpark. Yeah?
What?
Wang Buzaki? Stevens would have an R in the 6-ish range.
63.
So it can become substantially better by going beyond standard conductance-based neuron models here.
But is there anything other than cooperativity or that can work?
Okay. One thing I mentioned, you could try to have a more sensitive voltage sensor, a single neuron that is more voltage sensitive, a single channel that's more voltage sensitive.
No, we've seen some channels channels seem to have a threshold.
Yeah, so whatever makes the voltage dependence more sensitive, yeah.
So they don't ask them.
Could be independent channels, which, I mean, in the. So one thing that I tried to point out initially, and that is nicely expressed in David Hansen's discussion section, is that down here, that is where the AP initiation is happening, yeah, with low open probability, because we have not really very good data. There's unpublished data by Mike, and there's one paper by Peter Jonas that have a few data points down here. How does it look? 0, 0, 0 loop. So a step in the activation function of single channels could also do the job. Yeah? So I have no idea how biophysically you could build a channel that does this, but maybe if other stuff that's charged is attached to the channel, it may happen. So things different from cooperativity could give you a very rapid onset of the sodium current in the relative voltage range. Another thing that I should stress is that it's not important to turn on all sodium channels like one. A small fraction is completely sufficient for this to work, because you have to get into the AP and take this decision fast. It's not important to turn on each and every sodium channel as if it was one.
So to go back to your picture, what is R for this rapid rise, and you think is this cooperativity effect or whatever that's going to give this rapid rise? And what is that that you want in R from the previous picture?
What do you want? I mean, it's a theory. I don't want anything.
What do you think? I mean, what do you think?
Okay, so if you take there's different things. Yeah. If you take the somatic waveform, ignoring the good arguments not to do so as a proxy, you would be here in the 20, 30, 40s.
So that's quite a substantial drop in the loss of information.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, all right, we got two numbers up here.
Yeah.
It's not that interesting.
Well, no, you got infinitely many numbers out of me, because I give you the entire curve. And you can, for example, reason that maybe because you don't measure at the site of activation, the true R is even bigger. But so it's, what we want to provide is how things depend on R, and we will discuss what R would be interesting to consider. So it's clear conductance-based models are here below 10, And if you take the waveform ill-guidedly as a guide to the Zoom current, it would be around here, but it might be an underestimate or an overestimate, and that's what time needs to tell. Schleier.
How does it change what the neuron responds to with the faster answer?
Okay, that's a good question. So, buy me a beer. Because, I mean, there's another talk coming up. It's a wonderful question. I'd like to discuss it.
So, Fred, are you done?
We're not. I think we're not done, but we can continue.
Yeah, questions.
Yeah.
Have you looked
at finish up your conclusion?
Right, I had conclusions. So. So what were my conclusions? So blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that's, I think you got that point. That's, if it's biologically relevant or not, it's a neat effect, I think. I found it surprising that when you make the single neuron more unstable, you can suppress chaos in the collective dynamics. And it raises this issue, yeah, whether critical AP generators with their rapid onset action potentials are tailored to maintain information in microstate. So that's I want to pose that as a research question that we will try to find out more about, and we hope others will join. But that's a nice problem for theoretical neuroscience, I think. So what are open questions and perspective? Well, so as a theoretical physicist, you want to understand why this network chaos is extensive. We suspect it is because of the low correlations, but we don't have an analytical treatment to show that, so that's a challenge for theory. There's more needs that needs to be done in studying the impact of cellular parameters, as Adrian asked, so synaptic dynamics. Stochasticity of synaptic transmission is an important issue to put in before one concludes finally. So these are issues that need to be studied before.
The closest experimental realization to a network like this would be a culture, right? And you don't see these dynamics in cultures. So is there a reason for that?
Well, what dynamics do you see?
You don't see these long-lived, attractor-like, high-dimensional dynamics in cultures.
Well, I don't think that the wiring of the culture is the way what's really expect this. But Ahmed is working on a culture that may.
Yeah.
So it would be, so one thing would be so first learn to manipulate AP onset in living neurons and then put them into a network where you have a chance to see how long-lived states are. And yeah, that's so.
You can see
I can tell you later what our SF ideas are to move towards that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for instance, play around with the initial segments. Yeah. That's what we're trying, actually. Yeah.
I'd say that's
a given entropy production rate. Mm-hmm. Corresponds to a certain time scale,
yes,
where your information is coming.
Yeah.
So, does it play a role in biological context?
Yeah, okay, I didn't comment on the time scale. So these time scales are in the high entropy production rates region in the tens of milliseconds, and you can tune them to many hundred milliseconds. So you can reach behaviorally relevant time scales by okay rapid AP generators in these networks. Last question.
So Fred, for have you looked at the effect of large R on bigger perturbations like adding or subtracting a spike?
Not yet.
Okay.
Yeah. But we have to do that, absolutely. Thanks so much. I'll stop here.